When you hear the word war, some kinds of images probably come quickly to your mind. Maybe it's a destroyed city or a battle or an aircraft dropping bombs, or maybe now you picture hackers taking down a computer system or terrorists in the mountains. The way we think about war has changed as radically as the weapons that people use, but our war planners always seem out of step, fighting the last war, as the saying goes. And the way we get war wrong tends to determine just how vicious wars are likely to be. That's the subject of Lawrence Friedman's new book, The Future of War, published by Public Affairs. Welcome to our discussions with one of six authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2018 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is presented annually by the Lionel Gelber Foundation in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine and the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. These podcasts are sponsored by Focus Asset Management. I'm Rob Steiner. I'm the Director of the Fellowships in Global Journalism at the Monk School. Sir Lawrence Friedman is Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, and he's considered the Dean of Security Studies in the UK. In 2009, he won the Gelber Prize for his book, A Choice of Enemies, about America's role in the Middle East. He joins us from the UK. Sir Lawrence, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
So I wanted to start with an observation that you make right at the beginning of the book. It's quite a powerful illustration of how outdated our thinking about war it seems to be. And you point out that the idea of a decisive battle is quite a classical and outdated idea, that the world is moving into things that are far more complex. And yet, even as we talk about new threats like China, we tend to imagine some kind of decisive battle, the surprise morning attack from China or the surprise cyber attack from Russia. Are we just out of touch with the way that we should be thinking about war at this point?
I think the difficulty is that it's hard for people to start talking about future wars in ways that suggest that they're going to be inconclusive and messy affairs. They want to have a description of a future war that is stark. And the reason for that is partly, I suppose, a matter of comprehension and limits to our imagination, but also because the purpose of a lot of writing about future war isn't actually prediction. It's to urge policies on the present. It's saying this is a future that we may face if we don't do the right thing, or possibly a future we'll achieve if we do the right thing. So I think that tends to distort a lot of the writing about the future, because effectively much of it is advocacy concerned with influencing current choices.
But why is the view of advocacy, why does advocacy limit our perspective and sort of cast it in an outdated mold?
Well, I think there's two forms of advocacy. First, if you're actually contemplating a military move and wish to persuade people that this is the right thing, there's going to be a tendency, a human tendency, to look for all arguments which will show how successful this is going to be, forms of confirmation bias. And these are very strong. If you're talking about peacetime choices, then you have to start explaining why do we need this particular set of weapons? Why is this branch of the armed services important? And once you start doing that, you start to come up with scenarios which, again, demonstrate your point. So you're not trying to say how is a war likely to emerge or what form is it going to take. You're trying to say what forms of future conflict justify the policy prescriptions I'm making at the moment.
Right, or this particular weapon system or this particular deployment or doctrine that I'm thinking of. So I'm starting with what I'm advocating for, not necessarily the full scenario.
Yeah, if you're thinking about a new weapon system, you know, they can take years, even a decade or so, before they come into being. So in that sense, one person's guess is as good as another about what the world would look like at that time. So you fill it with a scenario that helps you make your point.
So you've been at the table, the senior government table, over many years and through many governments, and you've also been in sort of integrated tables, different kinds of international relations, thinking places like Chatham House and King's College. Do you find that in this realm we tend to get it more wrong than in other areas of complex international thinking like economics or climate change? Is there something, do you feel like the poor cousin sometimes at the table?
I think there's a difference when you're talking about war, is certainly if you're talking in our countries, for example, is that wars by and large are few and far between. And although in we've had ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, by and large, these are not the sort of events which people have in mind when they think about war. They still tend to think about these sort of great cataclysmic conflicts between major powers. And they don't happen very often, whereas climate change is ongoing, economics is changing every day. So you've got your indicators of change with you. With war, we tend to be talking about occasional disruptive events, and therefore which most of the time don't happen. So with that reason, it's very hard to get it right. And almost invariably, you're going to be taken by surprise when it does happen.
So I'm very conscious of the need, in a way, to avoid asking you what is likely to happen, given all of this. And in fact, it's a point that you make in the book, that that's actually not the purpose of the point in the book. So I'd rather actually go back to an example of what we're talking about here. And you point out that the great war historian and theorist Basil Littlehart, between World War I and World War II, he was looking at air power. A lot of people were looking at air power at the time. And he said something quite powerful and jarring. He said that the inaccuracy of bomb aim results in the inhumanity of war aim. So I'd like to ask, first of all, what he meant by that. And B, now that our aim with these bombs is getting better, is war actually becoming more humane?
Well, there's a lot of very interesting questions there. First, that quote comes from late in the Second World War.
Okay.
Second, Littlehart in the 20s, when he was first thinking about air power, thought of it as a good thing precisely because it could shock countries into early capitulation so that it could avoid the sort of horrific trench warfare that he'd seen in the First World War. So initially he started off as quite an advocate of air power. And then gradually, of course, people became more and more alarmed about what it might mean, and the inaccuracy of war aim, in particular of bomb aim. I mean, inaccuracy of bomb aim, in particular, refers to the difficulty that the Americans faced, who wanted to use air power against very specific, discriminated targets, and found that this was just too dangerous because it meant flying during the day. So they flew by night. And the bomb aim was inaccurate. The only targets you could be sure of hitting were big cities. I mean, it was better than that, but not that much better. But gradually, this sort of inhumanity of war aim, that you could bomb people into submission, did overtake not only the Germans with the Blitz, but effectively the British and American air forces as well, hence the great bombings of German cities and ending up with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, I think in the West, we've recoiled against that, and we now expect, because we have precision in bomb aim, the modern weapons are much more accurate, that only military or very military-related targets will be attacked. But in practice, of course, first, it's often difficult to get that quite right. But also, as we saw, for example, with the Russian bombing of Aleppo in support of the Syrian government, you can still achieve strategic effects through what appears as inhumane bombing campaigns that you may not be able to achieve if you're being discriminatory, because you lead people to flee their cities. So I think in the West, I think we'd find it very difficult to imagine going back to those great air raids of the Second World War. But that's not necessarily a view that you'll see elsewhere.
In fact, as we sort of bring the conversation to Russia, there's another dimension that starts striking me towards the end of your book, but the way that our thinking in a way doesn't quite catch up with where we may be. So I'd love your sense of what strikes me is a confusing way in which nuclear weapons have reemerged in our discussion about war. So we talk about them again, but now we tend to think of them in the conventional wisdom in the same breath as a rogue state. So we think of nuclear weapons, we think of North Korea, or we think of Iran. Russia and China, for that matter, are by far greater nuclear powers than either North Korea or Iran. They're clearly strategic opponents of the West now, as they were during the Cold War. But we don't instinctively think of them as nuclear threats. We think of them in other ways. Should we be thinking about Russia in particular more as a nuclear opponent again?
Well, I think the answer to the question is partly that the role nuclear weapons have played since 1945 has been in helping to remind people why a war between great powers is a bad idea. They're sort of embedded in our thinking. They impose limits on what the United States, Russia, and China might think of doing with each other. Now, there are challenging issues about whether these countries could engage in warfare in a limited way without escalating to nuclear use. That's an issue. And we've seen with Russia over the last few years a re-emphasis on its nuclear strength, precisely because it feels a need to remind the West that this is a country you don't mess with. The reason why North Korea and Iran and Iraq and others have gained attention for their nuclear arsenals, I think it's because these are seen as new factors in their regional security arrangements, and because they make it harder for the United States and others to influence events because they don't want to tangle with nuclear powers. So I think even for these countries, the role of nuclear weapons is still probably largely deterrent, but that deterrence may allow them to get away with more aggressive moves or seditious moves in their region than we might otherwise find acceptable and might wish to do something about. And you can see that very clearly with the current arguments over North Korea. North Korea only gains attention because of its nuclear arsenal. Otherwise, it's a completely failed state. But it's able to put up a warning sign now to the United States that if you tangle with us, these are going to be the consequences. And you can see that uncertainty in American policy between wanting to deal with this before they've got a surefire way of being able to attack the continental United States, and yet being aware that already they can do enormous damage to America's allies in the Pacific region, and probably to lots of Americans in the process.
So are we, does that mean in a sense we haven't sort of updated the way we think of deterrence? I mean, okay, so this still has a deterrent factor to some degree on both sides when you're talking about a rogue or failed state like North Korea or a rogue state like Iran, but the deterrence framework, the mental equipment we have to think of that comes out of a very different environment where we were actually thinking of a global great power with surrogates all over the world, bases all over the world, and so on. Has our thinking about nuclear deterrence evolved in a way that's useful actually to deal with North Korea, Iran, and other places?
Well, one of the problems with the way that we thought about nuclear deterrence during the Cold War was that we allowed it to get very complicated and apparently very sophisticated, whereas in reality it was always very simple. What sort of risks of complete disaster are you prepared to take in order to pursue your strategic interests? And with nuclear weapons, that risk was pretty low. Now, I didn't mean to say it deterred everything, because there were areas where nuclear deterrence just wasn't going to be engaged at all. But anything which seemed pretty big, nuclear weapons were there, so it had an effect. Now, one of the dangers of the success of deterrence is we assumed that it was easy to deter. It's easy to deter when you're talking about a risk of absolutely cataclysmic consequences that has some credibility. It's hard to deter if you're having to rely on other measures or interests are confused or it seems more marginal. So I think one of the difficulties is that the settings in which these issues are now discussed are much more complicated. If you're talking about the Middle East at the moment, with so many different different actors, the role that, say, Israel's nuclear arsenal plays or a future Iranian nuclear arsenal would play is going to be governed by so many different sorts of factors. It lacks the starkness that deterrence had during the Cold War.
To shift gears for a moment, you raise something in this book. It's such a conventional wisdom that most people don't even think to ask about it, which is this notion that democracies don't fight wars against one another. Is that true?
Sadly, no. First, it was an observation based on limited experience, because there weren't that many democracies until quite well into the 20th century, and even then there's a question of how democracy is defined. Can you be a democracy when women don't have the vote, for example? And then the 20th century had two very large wars in which, for most of the time, all the major democracies were involved. So actually what it turned out to be was a generalization from a rather benign period during the Cold War, when Western democracies in particular stuck together, and then this happy period after the end of the Cold War, when the number of democracies spread. But sadly, what the evidence then suggested is that when countries such as those in the former Yugoslavia were transitioning from autocracy into democracy, these can be very unstable times, and so countries that had certainly democratic forms of government did get into fights with each other. So, you know, we can say that countries that are like-minded and have similar values and cultural affinities don't fight each other. And as I mentioned before, by and large, countries don't fight each other full stop. There are not that many wars. But it's not an iron rule. It's not going to be true in all circumstances.
Your final chapter opens with a quotation from Matty Friedman's book. He's an Israeli soldier. He wrote about his experiences as an Israeli soldier in a very powerful book called Pumpkin Flower. And you quote from it, and I just want to read you that quote and ask for your quick thoughts. So he reads, I had been at the start of something, of a new era in which conflict surges, shifts, or fades. It doesn't end, in which the most you can hope for is not peace or the arrival of a better age, but only to remain safe as long as possible. Something that sounds like what Dexter Filkins used the title of his book, The Forever War, brought to mind the fact that Barack Obama was the first president ever in the United States to serve two full terms at war. So do wars end now?
Well, I mean, I think with difficulty is the answer. The best predictor of a future war is a past war. So even places where you think you've got a ceasefire and some peace treaty in place, they often go back to war. And, you know, the U.S. engagement in Iraq has been declared over a number of times, and yet it keeps on coming back. And this is particularly true with civil wars, which are the most common sort of war. When countries start to fall apart and tensions have risen and factions have formed, it's very difficult to put it together again. So we have quite a number of very long-running conflicts, and even when the levels of violence appear to have subsided, there's often a sense that unless major effort is put into political and economic reconstruction, what the World Bank once called the conflict trap, will reassert itself, the violence will come back. So, you know, just to take another example of the Ukraine, the basic outlines of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine were sort of sorted out by September 2014, but neither side has got a clear strategy for bringing the fighting to an end, and it still takes lives on a regular basis. And that's not unusual. The days where you had a decisive battle after which the losing side would acknowledge defeat and accept the terms of the enemy are over. It just doesn't happen that way anymore. Countries, even if you've suffered some sort of military defeat, there's always a sense that you'll have something in reserve, or you can come back again, or you can turn into irregular fighting. It's very difficult to actually pin down a victory.
Sir Lawrence, on that note, thank you very much for joining us and taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Sir Lawrence Friedman is the author of The Future of War, published by Public Affairs. If you'd like to hear more Lionel Gelber podcasts, you can find all of this year's discussions and many from previous years on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber Prize, that's G-E-L-B-E-R, or at our website, monkschool.utoronto.ca/Gelber. Thanks to the Lionel Gelber Foundation and Foreign Policy Magazine, and a special thanks to Focus Asset Management, funding media partner of these podcasts. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism, and thank you for joining us.